Welcome to our podcast.
If you enjoy this segment, we encourage you to check out the others. Also, if you're new to Hedgeye, you qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Darius Dell here, Senior Analyst on the Hedgeye Macro Team, to welcome you to our third Investing Summit. We appreciate you for joining us this morning. I'm joined this morning with for our first guest, Urien Timber. He's the Director of Global Macro and the Global Asset Allocation Division at Fidelity Investments. His primary role is to support the asset allocation process of Fidelity's multi-asset class solutions group. He obviously does this by analyzing market trends, economic data, et cetera, across all Fidelity Asset Management, where he co-managed the Global Strategies Fund from 2007 to 2014. So without further delay, let me just sort of introduce you, Urien. Appreciate you coming.
Thank you, Darius.
Thank you so much. So you're one of my favorite meetings. In full disclosure, Urien, and obviously Fidelity is a client on the institutional side, you're very specific. And what I mean by that, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to other investors, but you know, you being a macro guy, you know, we tend to speak mostly with bottom-up fundamental-oriented investors in the equities and credit in terms of our client base, but you're very specific about your macro views and you have very specific macro opinions, and I like that because we can get into a very, you know, interesting debate about the sequence, the path, the likely outcomes, the range of probable outcomes. So I really appreciate that. And one of the things you're very specific about is, or you're unsure in terms of the outcome, but you're very specific about maybe calling this a bear market and we potentially, you know, sort of moving into new highs and new territory over the intermediate term. So kind of walk me through that. Sort of walk me through your view that this is a bear market, in fact, a bear market, because obviously the market being just down under 2% from its highs, it would, you know, seem to suggest that that's not the case. So walk me through that logic and then sort of how you think about the next 12 months as it relates to potential upside.
Yeah, well, just to clarify, my base case is that this has been a bear market. Mm-hmm. Everyone seems to be anticipating the next bear market. Everyone mm-hmm. seems to be looking for that recession that's been elusive, but you know, maybe it's happening now. Mm-hmm. And I think what's where a lot of brain cells are being spent on in our industry is like calling that next bear market after a quintupling of the S&P over the last 10 years. Yeah. So my point is that why are we looking for the next bear market if essentially we've already had one? Mm-hmm. And so the way I look at that is, you know, fourth quarter of last year, S&P was down 20% for all of a New York minute, right? Yeah. But you know, the Shanghai Composite, EM, a lot of other parts of the world were down more than 20%. You know, China 30%, the ACWI, the MSCI All Country World Index down 23%. If you look at valuation, the PE ratio on the S&P peaked at 19.5 in January of 18. Yeah. It bottomed at 13.7 in December, right after Christmas in 2018. Mm-hmm. That's about a 28% haircut, I believe. PEs around the world are down about 25-30%, yeah. And in many parts of the world, they're still down there. Like mm-hmm. in the U.S., we're back to 17 or so, so about a 50% retracement. But in most of the rest of the world, they're still down there. You look at the CRB raw industrials, that's at the lows. And then another way of looking at it is, you know, I've been looking at charts for 35 years. I was mm-hmm. formerly a technical analyst. I still am, but not exclusively a technical analyst. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've learned is you look at the market not in isolation, whether it's up or down, but you look at it relative to its long-term trend line, right? Yep. So the long-term trend line, you know, the value proposition of investing in equities is you get 10-11% return over the long haul mm-hmm. Against a 15 vol. Yep. That's the price you pay for the return, is to have stomach churning volatility from time to time.
Indeed.
But usually the market is a pendulum swinging up and down ahead of the trend or behind the trend. Mm-hmm. So what we've seen since 09, which was the last major bear market bottom, is that we've had three runs where the market runs very strongly at a slope greater than the trend line of 10-11%, mm-hmm. and then it stalls and sits there and does nothing for months and months. So 2011 was a period like that, yep. 2015-16, yep. and now 2018-19. Yep. 19. So for the last 21 months, the market has done absolutely nothing.
Yep.
The MSCI All Country World is literally unchanged from 21 months ago. That's in total return terms. Mm-hmm. The S&P is up 5% from 21 months ago, but against what should have been a 20%+ move over that almost 2-year period, mm-hmm. you could call that a bear market, or at least a holding pattern or a consolidation. So mm-hmm. between the 20% drawdown, the almost 2 years behind trend, the sharp valuation haircut, I think I could easily make the case that we have seen a bear market. Now, whether it will continue or whether we've seen the end of it, and now that we have sort of a skinny deal on trade and mm-hmm. the Fed is now going to cut presumably again either in October or December and now doing $60 billion in QE that they call not QE. Mm-hmm. the next question is, has that holding pattern ended and are we about to run yet again?
Well, I think that is the most important question we should be asking ourselves as investors, because clearly we've seen a massive performance divergence between sort of more cyclically oriented sectors and style factors mm-hmm. and those that are traditionally sort of quote-unquote labeled defensives. If you look at sort of low beta min vol securities in the U.S. equity market, you know, they're up over 20% on a year-over-year basis, whereas something like the high beta ETF SPHB is up only 1%. And so you've seen this bifurcation across the equity markets manifest itself, you know, through multiple sectors and the deviations and divergences within those. You can make the case that does support the fact that we've seen sort of this rolling bear market, as you would sort of term it. Do you think the transition out of a bear market, either to the downside or to the upside, you know, back above the trend, do you think that is a function of the monetary policy, the trade truce, or just better economic data, and particularly on the earnings front? So can you walk me through, you know, how you're thinking about those three different factors?
Sure. I think it's probably a combination of all of the above. I mean, obviously, trade pressures have changed corporate's behavior. We're seeing that in the earnings numbers. Obviously, Q3 earnings season is really going to kick into high gear mm-hmm. This week. We've only had 21 companies reporting so far. And so we are seeing that companies are being cautious. Of course, companies will always blame whatever the headline of the day is, right? So it's all being blamed on trade. Yeah. You know, the Fed's response, I think, obviously is important. But, you know, if you look at the ISM or the PMIs more globally, they've been declining for over a year. The ISM's been falling for 13 months from mm-hmm. 62 to now 48. So you could argue that on the industrial manufacturing trade side, the global economy is in recession
yes.
already, like it was in 16, like it was in 98. Mm-hmm. But at those during those cycles and this cycle, the U.S. economy, which of course is mostly consumer-driven, mm-hmm. is still okay, decelerating, but still okay.
Still fine.
So I think it's a question of, you know, when you look at forward returns at different ISM prints, the lower you get below 50, the bigger your forward returns become.
Totally.
Just because cyclically, generally, you bottom somewhere in the 40s, so mm-hmm. it's just the math, right? 12
totally.
Months forward, your hit ratio starts going up. But the problem is that left tail does not get any less painful, even though the hit ratio goes up, right? So the cost of being wrong, even if your batting average may be 75%, is catastrophic. And I think we're kind of in that falling knife scenario where at a 48 ISM, really history starts getting on your side.
Totally.
But you may have to endure 3 or 6 or 9 more months of pain before you're right. You
know? Yeah.
And that's kind of the point where we're at.
Well, and as you know, our industry in particular has become increasingly short-term as it relates to you know, performance pressures, the anxieties around performance pressure. You know, as investors, you really, you know, so as professional investors, certainly, you don't really have 6 to 9 months to sort of be wrong. You sort of have to be, you know, kind of on it. It's an impossible job, but you certainly have to be on it. And so as it relates to, you know, getting to this next 12-month upside, does that require a recovery in this global economy? Actually, can you put on slide 27, Josephine? Slide 27, our Q4 macro themes deck sort of sequences the global economy through the lens of our GIP model, which you're familiar with. And so what you ones and twos are good. That means growth is accelerating in both of those quadrants. Threes and fours are bad. Those regimes have growth decelerating in common. And so to your point, to the point you made, we've been decelerating broadly from a global perspective all the way going back to the end of 2017.
Yep.
You know, so it's been almost 2 years of persistent deceleration. Clearly manufacturing is in recession across, you know, all these major economies. This morning we got industrial production data out of the Eurozone was down 2.8% year over year. Turkey down 3.6% year over year. These are August numbers. So the hard data is going to continue to catch down to the soft data, and we've yet to see a sustained inflection in the soft data. But effectively what you're saying is that this is the sort of, we're getting to these levels where it just makes sense to bet on a cyclical recovery. Is that a fair way to characterize that?
Yes. I mean, from what we're seeing, the numbers, same as what you're seeing, is that the numbers are bad and still getting worse, right? Mm-hmm. So what you want is you want them to be bad and get less bad, right? So that's when you get into that early cycle, mm-hmm. second derivative starting to improve while mm-hmm. the level is still going down. So mm-hmm. we're not there yet. So it is still kind of falling knife type territory. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that, you know, you're getting closer to that V, and from an asset allocation perspective, you know, if, let's say you were underweight risk 6 months ago, I don't know that I want to be underweight risk today. I may not want to be overweight risk, but mm-hmm. it's the kind of V that you start to rebalance into, and maybe you take a little off the table on the long duration side or on the bond proxy side. But having said that, actually, I think those trades have to do with the cyclical, where we are in the cycle, mm-hmm. but I think there's also a large demographic component, and obviously your own Neil Howe has written a lot about that, mm-hmm. but you know, the world's seeing a tidal wave of aging populations mm-hmm. in the US, Japan, China, Europe. I don't know that we've ever seen anything like it in terms of the size. And I think, you know, the global decline in yields has to do, obviously, financial repression by central banks and all that, and flight to quality. But I wonder how much of it is just demographics of people solving for yield rather than for growth, mm-hmm. because they're in that phase of the life cycle, and whether that is not going to keep yields bid really over a secular horizon rather than just cyclical. And I don't mean to change the topic here, but it's the same with utilities and REITs, and even like the leadership in the U.S. market, right? It's been the secular growers and the bond proxies. Now, mm-hmm. what do they have in common? They both generate mm-hmm. yield. Yep. The bond proxies are a stable, actual cash yield. The secular growers is more of a buyback type of yield. It's mm-hmm. not direct, but they have yield in common. And I think that is a long-term driver that may very well continue to dominate performance, even though we will have cyclical ebbs and flows, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of those cyclical ebbs and flows is associated with earnings.
Yes.
So you briefly mentioned that, you know, we have 22 companies already reporting for Q3 earnings, currently tracking down 13.3%, but the consensus expects that number to migrate to about down right around 4%, down 4% year over year in Q3. We see downside to those numbers, to down 5 to 8%, just based on our operating margin analysis and where we are in the business cycle with respect to inventories to sales ratios, with respect to, you know, the compensated employee costs and sort of unit labor costs more broadly speaking. And obviously the strong dollars has been a big headwind as well for corporate earnings. Talk to me about your outlook for a potential recovery, because clearly the street is very aggressive as it relates to Q4 and obviously 2020, with EPS assumptions up 10% year over year for next year.
Yeah, so you know, earnings it's kind of funny because it's sort of the oldest game in town. The estimates, so the sell side consensus estimates, always start too high. Then they fall about 800 basis points over a couple of quarters, and then as we get into the reporting season, mm-hmm. The number always bottoms right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So in the, let's say, the first or second week of the quarter, right on the cusp of reporting season, mm-hmm. and then it bounces 300 to 400 basis points from there. So CEOs like to set low expectations and yep. then beat them.
Absolutely.
And no matter how long we know this pattern, it still always happens, right? Totally. And so generally the numbers start at about 11%, 12% in the year prior to the calendar year number, and that's where the 2020 number is right now. It's at 10%. Mm-hmm. The 2019 number was at 12% at the end of last year. It's now at 2.3% and mm-hmm. still falling, although moderately. Of course, last year was 22%, so it's not unreasonable to expect some give back from that number.
Totally.
But for next year, it's 10%. I think, as you said, there's clearly downside risk to that, as there always is, the trend rate, the trend growth rate is 7, mm-hmm. 5 to 7. So we will probably get down there, and usually the fourth quarter of the prior year, which would be this current quarter now, calendar quarter, is when the numbers start coming down, probably mm-hmm. because the next year gets onto people's radar screen. They mm-hmm. they scrutinize the number a little bit more. They stop sort of extrapolating, you know, long-term trends, and they actually do the math of what the companies are going to do. So there's downside risk to 2020. And for the current reporting quarter, the Bloomberg consensus number, where they aggregate the sell side, is at minus 3.8. Mm-hmm. The first quarter was at minus 3.9 at the beginning. Second quarter was minus 2.7, I think, at the beginning. Both of those quarters ended up seeing a 400 basis point recovery, and both quarters just eked out a positive year-over-year growth rate for the quarter, not for the four-quarter period, but for the quarterly period. And so far, we've been able to avoid a negative print. Mm-hmm. And at currently minus 3.8, if we get a 400 basis point recovery, Q3 could be a repeat of the first two.
Totally.
But we are much further into the trade war, if you will.
Yep.
So maybe we beat by less this time and actually will see a negative quarter, but it won't be as negative as what we're seeing now, because the companies do generally beat the estimates. It's just a question of to what degree.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I'm looking at earnings season.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because you lower the bar low enough and you can beat. But the expectation for recovery is something that I'm really, really keen on focusing on here, because I make this point all the time on our macro show and our publications, we're not at an inconsequential point in the business cycle,
right,
as it relates to a potential GDP recovery, as it relates to a potential earnings recovery. If you throw up slide 30, I think slide 30 is one of the most important charts that I can sort of show investors as it relates to the U.S. economy specifically. So, you know, we're constantly now casting what economic momentum and inflation momentum are doing intra-quarter and intra-period, but then we use our comparative base effect model to extrapolate what that momentum implies over the next 12-month time horizon. If you use a two-year base effect, it effectively says the Fed is engineering a soft landing. That's the left chart here on the screen. If you use a three-year base effect, which includes pulls back into the observation window, the positive deviation, mm-hmm, from the trend line on growth from the Shanghai Accord, the positive deviation that was associated with the corporate tax reform in the U.S., it's very likely that we continue to slow against those base effects well into 2020. We can't get to recession in either scenario as it relates to the quarter-over-quarter SAR numbers, but you can get some pretty low prints. We're talking, you know, with downside potentially to 0.5% on a quarter-over-quarter SAR basis in Q4. You know, not much of a recovery beyond that, because obviously the SAR numbers have to catch down to those year-over-year prints. So to me, I really wonder, just based on, you know, this one, that mathematical outlook, but more importantly, thinking about the labor cycle. Because to me, the labor cycle is the tail wagging the dog here. I have three charts. You know, I think it's important to show the investors these three charts, and then we can sort of discuss what they in fact mean as it relates to this earnings recovery. So if we go to slide 38, Josephine, the first chart there, we're just showing, you know, where we are. So if you think about, you go back to 2015, 2016, where we're on the lows, just like we are currently. You had what ultimately turns out to be the biggest fiscal and monetary stimulus in China's history, coincided with the Fed dropping its dot plot. Mm-hmm. So that was the 2015-2016, yep, Shanghai Accord. That helped get us off the lows, and what perpetuated those further highs, particularly in the U.S. economy, was the, you know, change in tax policy domestically. So you almost have to wonder now where we are in the labor cycle. If you look at jobless claims on a rolling 6-month average basis on the left chart, you know, we're well beyond late cycle in terms of, you know, what has historically signaled late cycle. But more importantly, I think the more important indicator that we like to look at is the spread between the U6 rate and the U3 rate as a proxy for labor market slack. And we're at levels that have historically been signaling very late cycle from that perspective. Mm-hmm. The next chart shows the rate of year-over-year rate of change in private sector wage growth vis-a-vis sort of total non-private sector payrolls. And what you see is that as you get deeper and deeper into the cycle, and as the supply of labor starts to run out, you just start to slow organically, because you run out of people to hire, you run out of people to pull off the couch. And so the key takeaway on all this analysis on slide 40, you run out of people to pull off the couch, you reduce the supply of any good, the price tends to go up if there's no change in,
yep,
demand. We're now seeing the cyclical recovery that we see in unit labor costs at the end of every economic expansion. And to what point do those really start to bite into corporate earnings and prevent corporate earnings from actually recovering in a manner that allows, you know, sort of the upside deviation back above trend to the market, yep, you sort of highlighted. So sort of walked me through the potentiality for all this to sort of just be the tail wagging the dog as it relates to those 2020 numbers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great observation. I mean, we are clearly in late cycle, and we were sort of in early late cycle.
Early
now
late
we're
cycle.
Getting into later late cycle.
Yeah.
And my sense from talking to people on the street is that the only thing missing for everyone to declare late cycle has morphed into a down cycle, a recession, is the claims, right? The jobless, everyone is just waiting for their jobless claims
every Thursday
to tick up and for that moving average crossover to kick in. Yeah. And then it's like, okay, now we can sell, because my sense is that people are bearish, but they're kind of fully invested bears, or they're fully invested, maybe with a tilt towards the safe quality sectors. So I do think it is about the claims, but the thing about this cycle and the last cycle, if you count 15, 16 as sort of a mini cycle,
which we do,
is that you have this global industrial cycle that's in contraction. China tends to be at the center of it, and I think it is, today as well. I mean, we can talk about trade, which has been going on now for almost 2 years, but basically China was already slowing before that. Totally. I mean, you can only go back to the well so many times to create yet another credit impulse, mm-hmm. and to build more stuff. Eventually, your cycle, your economy matures, and you can't do that anymore. So I think China is dealing with issues much beyond just tariffs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are.
And so, China has been reflating and stimulating their system enough to keep it stable, to keep it from falling, mm-hmm. but not enough to create one of those 2016 type of booms. I mean, back then the PBOC was direct lending into the economy via the policy banks. Mm-hmm. It's not really doing that, at least not yet. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a reticence among the Chinese government to kind of go back to the well again. So I don't think we're going to see necessarily another surge in 2020 economically. Mm-hmm. Europe has issues. I was just in Frankfurt a few weeks ago. Europe is overbanked. They're all well capitalized because of the regulatory requirements.
Of course.
But their books are too big. There's too many banks. They can't really merge because the ECB has onerous capital requirements on mergers. Mm-hmm. A bank in one country can't really buy a bank in the other because it's just culturally different, regulatorily. Exactly. There are differences. So the banks have to shrink. Either they have to, and the way they're doing it is they're shrinking their balance sheet. So
exactly.
Europe is 80% banked.
Yep.
And if your banks are shrinking, you're not really going to grow your economy. So it's hard to see where a really robust expansion is going to come from, other than from the U.S., but that's already been kind of the big show. Mm-hmm. And we had the tax cuts. We have the fiscal stimulus in a full employment economy already. So it's hard to see where this next set of extra innings is going to come from. But on the other hand, the business cycle has gotten longer and tamer and quieter as manufacturing becomes less and less part of the economy, and as policy responses are quicker. I mean,
they're much quicker.
A year ago, we didn't think the Fed was going to be cutting and doing more balance sheet expansion now, but yet here they are doing it. Mm-hmm. So, my sense has always been that you get a recession because there's a policy error, and you get a bad recession because there's a policy error on top of a big financial excess. Like we had in 2008. Mm-hmm. Other than corporate balance sheets in the U.S. and maybe the Chinese financial system, it's hard to see, and those are two big things, by the way, I don't mean to dismiss it, but it's hard for me to see a bad recession in the U.S. because the Fed's already on board. Maybe the Fed's not doing enough, granted, but other than the corporate balance sheet, which has been mostly financial engineering type of leverage as opposed to building a bunch of stuff that then has to be, sit there idle in a recession. Mm-hmm. There's not really a lot else that I can point to, which tells me that maybe we just stay in this lukewarm 2% environment for a long time. And certainly demographically, you could argue that is what's going to happen. I mean, look at Japan. Japan is in recession a lot just because their speed limit is so low. It doesn't take much.
Totally.
And in the U.S. and Europe, maybe that's kind of where we're going.
Yeah, so I always like to make the case that, sort of as each of these economies ages, the terminal rate that you sort of highlighted or alluded to, that stall speed just starts to shrink and shrink. Mm-hmm. Maybe stall speed in the U.S. is 1%, in Europe is probably 0%, in Japan it's, a little bit less than that. And so, not less than that because then obviously they're in recession, but, to the extent that you don't have a major policy response to sort of get you above stall speed, you know, what's the ultimate downside risk? Because again, I agree with you. We certainly agree with you when we have discussions with investors, and certainly anyone analyzing the micro data, the company level data, can see that, you know, earnings are effectively about to slow into recession. You know, the first, you know, down year over year quarter we've seen since going back to the last manufacturing downturn in 2016. What gets the numbers to the upside? I mean, you go back to slide 30, 31, and 32. You know, Europe, China. It's all the same picture. You know, the world. Go to 31. That's China on 31. So, you know, you go back to this magic moment in time at the lows of 2015, 16, where China said go, the Fed said go, mm-hmm. and then obviously in 2017, U.S. Congress said go again, as relates to stimulus. Now we're just comping against that stimulus. That stimulus there on the left side of this chart, you know, that was right into Xi's coronation for life, effectively. Yep. Got the entire Chinese industrial economy up, resuscitated the global economy. Now we're comparing against that. I mean, this is, you know, rate of change math. As you know, the comparative base is really important. Now we're just comparing against that. But if you look at a three-year that pulls back in those observations, China's likely to continue slowing well into the first part of next year. The next chart shows Europe's unlikely to recover. Europe's unlikely to recover regardless because of its demographic issues, because of the banking sector issues. So you have to really worry about this. You know, to me, the big question is, do you become more offensive here or now or in some point in the immediate future? And more importantly, do you sell your duration and your assets that are sensitive to duration risk? We think we know the answer, and we're certainly still, you know, sticking with the bear case because we definitely think there's downside risk to growth and downside risk to those expectations. What if China is just 1989 Japan? I have a few charts I kind of want to walk through on China because I do think there's a risk of China just not being able to recover amid a strong dollar, starting with slide 33. So on slide 33 here, we're just showing the trade weighted U.S. dollar index on a monthly average basis at all time high, effectively with respect to the Fed's index. Obviously, it's much higher back in the 80s. But what that's had, it's having a deleterious impact on sort of China's capital and current accounts, and that's obviously slowing growth because of the closed capital account nature of their economy. On slide 34, you know, China's effectively morphing into, you know, what we're showing here is the net financial account as a percentage of GDP. China's morphing into a more traditional emerging market overnight, not overnight, but it's certainly happening. You know, it's an ongoing issue for them, and the reason that's an ongoing issue for them is because even more so than the European economy, the Chinese economy is overbanked. So obviously leverage is an issue in the Chinese economy with respect to its non-financial sector leverage. But more importantly, 80% of that leverage, four-fifths of that leverage is on bank balance sheet. Yeah. So if you can track the growth rate of credit on the bank balance sheet in China, you can effectively track, you know, and with a real, you know, decent lead on economic activity. And what we're seeing right now is on slide 35 that the net result of that is actually it's getting worse at its fastest rate. So the strong dollar is really preventing the Chinese sort of economy from having sort of more traditional response to, you know, the triple R cuts, reserve requirement ratio cuts that we've seen really going all the way back to last April.
And it applies to EMs in general because EMs are short the dollar.
Everyone's short the dollar. So as the dollar goes up, effectively all you're doing by easing is just sort of ameliorating that impact. Yeah. You're effectively running on a treadmill, as I like to say. Yeah. And so the Chinese economy is running on the treadmill. On that chart on the left here on slide 35, we're showing the triple R rate. In China, the red line, the black line is interbank lending rates. The SHIBOR, 3-month SHIBOR, hasn't budged in a year. They've cut the triple R rate by 400 basis points in the year to date, and it's done absolutely nothing to interbank lending rates. Which, if you think about what lowering the triple R rate implies, you're unleashing liquidity into the banking sector, but it's clearly not being unleashed. And the reason and the net result of that is we continue to see financial tightening in China. The growth rate of credit on bank balance sheets slowed in September to 12.4% year over year. That's the lowest rate of change we've seen since May of 2005.
Yep.
So it's all working in reverse now because of the strong dollar. So to me, it goes back to this point we've been trying to make, you know, with this black hole of market risk. The key takeaway here is on slide 36. Will the Fed acknowledge where we are in the business cycle? And will the Fed acknowledge the ultimate downside risk to both the U.S. and the global economies associated with their policy mix being too tight? If you think about how, you know, pancake the yield curves are and where inflation break-evens are, it's effectively telling the Fed, and there's some smart people in the Fed who believe, you know, in these market signals, that it's telling their policies too tight. They need to do something that will allow China to stimulate more aggressively, that will allow emerging markets in Europe to stimulate more aggressively and get this sort of manufacturing sort of cycle off its lows. You know, we're showing here on this chart here is just the Fed's dot plot, which is the gray line or the green line versus, you know, overnight index swap spreads and Fed fund future spreads, and it's that diverges. We haven't seen such a divergence like that since probably the middle part of 2015, And so they effectively, by the end of 2015 and certainly at the 2016 lows, they finally figured out that they had a policy mix that was just too tight from a forward guidance perspective. And I think the black hole of market risk we've been talking about effectively all Q3 and into Q4 here associated with the negativity we see coming in earnings, we think the markets are going to have to force the Fed to really capitulate on where that upsloping curve implies to get a real recovery in cycles.
And the question is, will it be too late then, right?
That's the issue.
I mean, so the Fed's going along begrudgingly with the markets, but at a much slower pace and using the language of like mid-cycle adjustment. Mm-hmm. So, the Fed's in a really tough bind. I mean, they're not in an enviable position because mm-hmm. they look at coincident indicators. And yes, the ISM is below 50, but other than that, the economy is still growing above trend.
Totally.
So they really shouldn't be easing from that perspective.
Totally.
You look at the forward indicators, the yield curve, money growth, that's telling a different story. But for the Fed to signal a full easing cycle rather than a mid-cycle adjustment, which mm-hmm. is what they've been doing, they would need to put all their chips on these market indicators.
Totally.
And of course, markets are often wrong. Market's wrong all the time. I mean, the market was looking at for four more cuts last week, and it's like two to three more this week because of the trade headline.
Totally.
So they can't really always capitulate to the market. And if they do, it's really a leap of faith, and then you run the risk that they lose credibility because then they're seesawing back and forth.
Oh, yeah.
So I think the Fed is in a difficult spot, but the way I look at it, inflation's been running below the Fed's target for 10 years,
mm-hmm.
okay? And, if you told me 7-8 years ago when the Fed was in full QE mode in, like, 2010, 2011, and you ask me, is inflation going to overshoot down the road? Of course, the answer would be yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so if after all of that, zero rates, QE, $4 trillion, you still cannot get above 2% inflation, then you actually can take that leap of faith and say, screw it, let's cut to 1% and give the markets what it wants. What's the worst thing that could happen? Is that mm-hmm. inflation overshoot and then you tighten? And inflation overshooting is not really the worst thing you can ask
for. Isn't that what they want?
And that's what the whole average inflation targeting thing is about overshooting over the near term to catch up from the past. So mm-hmm. there really is very little opportunity cost other than credibility.
Yes.
And sort of that, jerky reactionary mode of conducting policy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's probably a political element as well where they don't want to be seeing, taking orders from the White House. But you could argue that there's a lot less cost of just going big now and seeing what happens, just to give the benefit of the doubt to the market indicators.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can reverse it later if you need to. And if the conditions are there to justify a reversal, the market will be totally on board. The market was totally on board for the last 8 rate hikes. The,
mm-hmm.
the markets didn't sell off. They were totally fine. It's when, the problem is when you look at the discounted cash flow model, which I'm a big believer in, right? So you mm-hmm. put in earnings growth or free cash flow growth in the numerator, and you put in the cost of capital in the denominator, mm-hmm. and that's the risk-free rate, the 10-year treasury, plus the equity risk premium.
Mm-hmm.
When the numerator is growing at very small, to a very small degree like it is now, 2% growth in 2019,
mm-hmm.
you almost get like a bond convexity effect on valuation.
Yes.
Changes in a discount rate have a disproportionate effect on the fair value of the market
totally.
When your numerator is growing by 2 as opposed to
3,
by
4.
10.
Yeah.
And so this is why back in 15, when Janet Yellen tried to raise rates and then it had to walk back because it had the market threw such a temper tantrum.
Totally.
It's because we were earnings growth was negative.
Yes.
So any little change in the discount rate is going to really knock the market down. But when earnings growth is 20% as it was in 2008, the market's like, I don't care. You can raise rates all you want.
Absolutely.
So it really becomes a math issue. And I think maybe that's something that the Fed is not as good at because there are economic academics for the most part. I mean, mm-hmm. Powell's not an academic. He's more like Greenspan. But I don't think they think of the economy as a transmission mechanism for the markets in through that particular lens.
Yeah, that's very important. I think the most important transmission mechanism, we joke all the time that Jay Powell's, you know, worth $100 million from his days at Carlyle. He understands, he gets the credit machine, you know, the leverage machine in the cycle. And to his credit, and to the Fed's credit, as it relates to their reluctance to be more aggressive with policy, high yield spreads, if you look at sort of, you know, double Bs or whatnot, they're out there 390 over. You know, you go back to the sort of the mini tangents we had in August and May of this year, got up to about 450, clearly well over 500 in Q4 of last year. Now, credit spreads are either they're signaling one of two things, because we're seeing this divergence in credit spreads when you look at, you know, so you go beyond the index level, right? You look at something as high as double Bs, you know, they're tight and falling as most recently as last week, down 29 basis points on that index. But you look at something like triple Cs, they're widening in further. And so you're seeing this divergence in credit markets that may be signaling something that much more sort of deleterious underneath the hood as it relates to the broader business cycle. Because clearly their policies have an impact on duration and people's sort of willingness to reach for yield or what they perceive to be safe yield. But underneath the hood, you're starting to see, and I say this with the sectors, you know, there's so many sectors and industries that are themselves in bear markets, maybe not by the traditional sense of, you know, of not, you know, being up, not the traditional sense of being down 10 to 20%, but much more in the traditional sense of being lagging the market very aggressively.
Yeah. And in terms of valuation,
and in terms
financials,
of
industrials, materials,
totally.
They all had haircuts of 30% or more.
Absolutely. So it really, you know, you hate to hinge your asset allocation on an institution that is historically very lagging.
Yep.
You know, you tend to want to sort of be more forward-looking. You know, the whole point of the growth inflation policy model is to use proactively predictable variables to front-run changes in monetary policy that ultimately have a very big impact on asset markets. You know, we're at this really interesting place where it could be quad two or quad three in Q4, but the likelihood of a sustained recovery off these sort of manufacturing cycle lows is as low as it's been at any point in the last decade. And so to me, that's always been the big risk. We're going to turn over some questions.
Sure.
Absolutely. Appreciate it. And just a reminder, pop as many questions as you can in this chat stream. So we've got, you know, about 15, 20 minutes. We'll try to do as many as we can here. So first question, Aman is asking, do you think the Fed will adjust and cut enough to stave off recession in your opinion?
That is a good question. I think they probably will. I'm not necessarily calling for a recession. I mean, but as we were talking about earlier, the risk is that the Fed is assuming no recession, so it's doing the mid-cycle adjustment, and you know, and the QE that it's not doing is not QE. It's just buying T-bills to provide liquidity. So that's fair enough. And for them to, by the time they will conclude that they are wrong, and that they need to go a full cycle, which is several hundred basis points.
It's 500 on average, right?
500 on average. Then it's probably too late, because at that point, the curve is kind of disinverting a little bit here. It's not as inverted as it was. But by if the curve's inverted for a few weeks,
not a big deal.
A few months, okay. You know, you got to start paying attention. But the longer it stays inverted, the more damaging it becomes. Mm-hmm. And so for the Fed, the risk is that, you know, our star, which is currently at about 0.5% real, so let's say 2.5% nominal, has been flatlining. It's actually coming down a little bit. Of course, it's a very it's a theoretical construct, so we don't really know what it does in real time. But the risk for the Fed is that it's going to fall behind the curve of a falling R star, and that they're just misjudging the cycle. You know, I think the Fed is hoping that this is 95 or 98 mid-cycle adjustment. You know, they over tightened, they eased a couple times. That's all it needed, all that was required. But if they need to go a full cycle, and they're going to do maybe one more, then by the time they figured out that they do more, you run the risk that the recession has basically already happened.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it is a risk. And that's why I was saying earlier, you know, if there was ever a time where they could have a low opportunity cost to do more rather than less, it's now, after a 10-year chronic undershoot of inflation. But, you know, they don't want to spend their ammunition. They see how difficult it is for the ECB and the BOJ to do negative interest rates. I don't think anyone actually believes that negative rates work, but the central banks feel like they have to do something. Like the latest cut from the ECB, and again, I was just there a few weeks ago. My sense, I mean, nobody's going to tell me this, but my sense is that they don't really think it's going to do anything, but they can't be seen doing nothing.
Totally.
And so they're going to cut it from negative 0.3 to negative 0.4 and mm-hmm. do some QE. And I think the Fed just does not want to get into that ball game. But you know, chances are eventually it's going to happen, right? Because we're following Europe, which is following Japan in terms of the demographics. And so they have to get used to it, I guess.
Yeah, they certainly do. One of the assets that obviously really benefit if they, quote unquote, get used to it is gold. What are your views on gold?
Gold has become a bond proxy.
Yes.
Right? I mean, we've all seen the chart of the negative yielding debt overlaid against the price of gold. It's, you know, they're perfectly correlated. Gold is a play on real rates, probably more than anything else. You know, if you look at the TIPS yield, really a very strong inverse correlation over the last 10 years or so. And what we are, you know, I'm convinced, I don't know where we are going cyclically, whether it's a recession or a recovery, but I'm convinced that over the next 10 years, as this demographic sort of tsunami sweeps around the most of the world, and you look, you know, U.S., Japan, Europe, China, I don't know what the population number is, but that's a lot of people that this is affecting. And so I think yields will stay low, and when you combine demographics with debt, it's sort of like the two-headed monster. You know, if you can't grow your way out of debt, which demographically we can't really do, we did it in the 50s and 60s, but we can't do it now, then you're going to have to sort of inflate or devalue your way out of debt. And devaluation from a currency perspective is going to be hard because everyone else is doing the same thing.
Exactly.
Right? That only works if you're the only one in debt.
Yeah.
So then the other way is to just devalue your way through negative interest rates,
Negative real rates.
So if real rates are going to be, they're already negative on some terms, but if they're going to get increasingly more negative, then gold is going to have a place. And, you know, we're at $15 trillion negative yielding debt. We were at $17 trillion maybe a month ago. Mm-hmm. If you overlay the amount of negative yielding debt against the rate, the 10-year rate of change of the population 65 and older in the U.S., there's a very obvious correlation. Mm-hmm. And that demographic bulge is going to continue for another 5 to 10 years.
So in the U.S.
In the U.S. alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you could argue that the negative yielding debt is going to be at 25 trillion easily, and then you're looking at gold, you know, well north of 2,000 if that happens, if not higher. So, you know, Warren Buffett always liked to diss gold because it didn't have a yield. Well, in a negative yielding world, a zero yield is a high yielding asset all of a sudden. So yes, I like gold from that perspective.
Indeed, we do too as well.
And gold is less convex than bonds, and so convexity of course helps you. If the U.S. 10-year goes from 1.5 to 1, that's a big run. But from 1 to 1.5 is going to get really ugly, and that's. At some point, that's going to happen, and gold just doesn't have that mathematical, characteristic.
Absolutely, we saw the convexity in full force last week. Treasury bonds in the long game were down 3.8% on a 20 basis point backup. So you're really starting to see that, and it's clearly happening across financial markets.
And you know, and that makes me think of another component to this. You know, back in the Greenspan days, we had the Fed model, right? You look at the earnings yield versus the bond yield. If one stretches versus the other, you have a signal, right?
Totally.
A reversal signal. Well, since the financial crisis, that hasn't worked.
No,
and at a 1.5% bond yield, that is a sort of a PE, for lack of a better word, of 67.
Yeah.
You know? A 5% yield is a 20 PE. A 1% yield is 100 PE, and a 0.1% yield is 1,000 PE, right? Mm-hmm. So the S&P trading at 18 times trailing, 17 times forward, where should that be trading if bonds are trading at a 1,000 PE or at 100 PE? But that's a big question, right? Should they be worth more? Are we going to be looking 5 years from now at an S&P trading at a 50 multiple just because people need yield, and they may not be bidding up the S&P in its entirety, but they're going to be bidding up the parts of the S&P that generate some sort of yield. I mean, I don't have the answer to that, but I think that is one of the big existential questions we need to ask ourselves. And you could argue that it's not going to happen because otherwise it would have happened in Europe and Japan already. But that's culturally a different part of the world. You know, people don't invest in stocks over there individually. Like
there's no growth.
but also you get a pension, and it's not how people really operate, culturally. But here we're in a do-it-yourself environment. So, I don't know the answer, but it's a provocative question to ask that if we go towards zero yields here, that's not a prediction on the long end. What will that do to the valuation of assets that compete against that yield?
Well, I got an even better question on the other side of that. If we go, you're thinking about this from the perspective of valuation, but what about the E itself? If you go back to slide 40, this to me is one of the most important charts in macro, in all of global macro, is the relationship between labor and profits domestically. So, there's a few things you sort of take away from this chart. One, labor's always high and rising into recession. So cyclically, it's a later cycle indicator. And we're certainly having a cyclical upswing in unit labor costs now with private sector wage growth, sort of hanging out near cycle peaks. This is the most recent jobs report. But you can take a step back and say, well, what do both parties want now as it relates to sort of the nationalism and the sort of, some call it socialism, whatever you want to call it on both sides of the aisle.
Populism,
yeah. I guess, yeah, that's the PC term for it. Populism. You're going to have both parties effectively arguing to get that green line up sustainably. Yeah. What that obviously, just as a relationship to total, income and total GDP, the black line has to come down. It could come down sustainably for a long period of time. We could be in a secular bear market in the E as it relates to that. So you could get, there's two ways, obviously, to get multiple expansion. The price can go up, but you can go down. So that's always something to keep in mind as well.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So Michelle's asking, what's the main difference between Q4 of 18 and the third quarter of 2019, where one saw a 20% decline in the market and the sort of this most recent downturn, or we call it quad four here in the U.S. where growth and inflation are slowing, did really little to nothing to the S&P 500. It's just a function of the Fed being more dovish. And then I'll just add a secondary question. If the Fed continues to be more dovish, does it sort of augur for much more upside in the markets?
So that's a great question. So in Q4 of 2018, of course, the Fed was still on the brink of a policy error, right? I mean, it was really, so in December, it still raised rates. It made the comment about balance sheet being on autopilot, which certainly in retrospect seemed to be terribly naive because of the liquidity funding that kind of came out. And then the Fed saw a turnover at the New York Fed, with the markets, the head of the markets area. So they were a little tone deaf in the fourth quarter, and it took a few quarters for them to really see that, this is actually, this stuff is actually slowing down. So I think also Q4, the 20%, in my view, really should have been a 10 to 15%, but there was no liquidity. If you looked at the depth of the book on the E-minis, for instance, anytime the bots started selling, the market just dried up.
Totally.
And so I think it exaggerated what would have been just a correction into something worse. And that's one of the reasons why it reversed so quickly as well. I mean, it was over before you even knew it. So now the economy clearly is slower, but we now have a firmer policy response. We're two cuts in, we probably get one or two more at least, and we have some balance sheet expansion now. And also, valuations, they're certainly higher than they were in Q4. Q4 they had fallen to 13.7 on the forward PE. For the S&P, we're at about probably 17-ish right now. That's certainly up from 13.7, but it's still down from the 19.5 that we saw in January 18 at that initial peak right before that whole VIX flash crash.
Yeah,
So I think the market, it's not cheap, but it's not at nosebleed levels either. And I think, markets always discount the future, right? And in December of last year, the market was discounting a much more unclear future. I mean, it's still unclear now, but at least now we have ECB, we have the Fed, and I think, and as we were talking about earlier, now you have a 48 ISM as opposed to, I don't know what it was in December, but it's probably mid-50s.
Yeah.
So you're getting just closer to that part of the playbook, like quad four, right? Mm-hmm. You know that something good is gonna happen after quad four, but you just need to wait for the sun to come up first, or at least to start seeing it come up. So I think you just get closer to the next phase of the playbook, and maybe that's why the markets are a little bit more sanguine today.
Totally, and just to end on that point, you go to slide 41 in the deck, that's a great sort of way to end. you know, one of the things we're thinking about, we call it sort of full cycle investing. You know, we think about everything from a year-over-year rate of change perspective. You know, when do you peak in year-over-year rate of change and big things like growth, inflation, and profits? When do you bottom? What this analysis here is showing is sort of sequencing all of the sort of mid-cycle and or late-cycle slowdowns we've mm-hmm. seen off the peak in GDP growth to the inevitable trough in GDP growth, and sequencing that transition out of quad four, usually quad four, into quad one or quad two, which is where growth inflects and it accelerates higher. What you've seen historically is that almost, unless you're explicitly in recession, which is obviously the sort of 91 sort of corollary and then ultimately the 09 corollary, unless you're explicitly in recession, the data is very obvious. The market needs more time to confirm the inflection because it's still worried about the recession potentially showing up in the future. And so, you know, to us, it's all about, again, where are we in the labor cycle? We're a much later cycle than we were in 15, 16, which makes this a much more precarious much more precarious path for recovery. Earnings, clearly, you know, that's associated with the other side of that is can earnings recover? You know, can business fixed investment mm-hmm. really start to recover in the context of all the sort of geopolitical headwinds that we have? You know, those are two really big ifs. And so to us, and, you know, sort of how we think about asset allocation is just staying defensive. You know, why be out there in a rush
or stay diversified, right? A 60-40 since the beginning of 18, when the valuation peak happened, has basically captured most of the S&P's upside and only half of the downside.
Mm-hmm.
So,
totally.
There's nothing not to like about staying diversified.
Indeed. Know? All right, Urien, thank you so much. We appreciate it. This is really awesome. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. As a reminder, new Hedgeye subscribers may qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com. Hedgeye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. Hedgeye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of Hedgeye, and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither Hedgeye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions and conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.